Please open up with me to 1 Chronicles 11. It's on page 342 in the Bible under your chair. We're going to read the second, maybe half of this chapter is the list of the mighty men, but we're going to read the whole chapter because these are David's mighty men and God wrote down to honor them, so we should honor them as well. I know we've done a lot of lists in the past 2 months or so, but bear with us for one more list. These are special people that God chose out. This is God's holy word, 1 Chronicles 11. Then all Israel gathered together to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, even when Saul was king, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord your God said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over my people Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel, according to the word of the Lord by Samuel. And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, that is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. The inhabitants of Jebus said to David, 'You will not come in here.' Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And David said, 'Whoever strikes the Jebusites first shall be chief and commander.' And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first, so he became chief. And David lived in the stronghold. Therefore, it was called the city of David. And he built the city all around from the Millo in complete circuit. And Joab repaired the rest of the city. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him. Now these are the chiefs of David's mighty men who gave him strong support in his kingdom, together with all Israel, to make him king, according to the word of the Lord concerning Israel. This is an account of David's mighty men. Jashobeam, a Hakmonite, was chief of the three. He wielded his spear against 300 whom he killed at one time. And next to him, among the three mighty men, was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Achite. He was with David at Pasdamim, when the Philistines were gathered there for battle. There was a plot of ground full of barley, and the men fled from the Philistines. But he took his stand in the middle of the plot, and defended it, and killed the Philistines. And the Lord saved them by a great victory. Three of the 30 chief men went down to the rock to David at the cave of Adullam, when the army of Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then at Bethlehem. And David said longingly, 'Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem that is by the gate.' Then the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water from out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and took it and brought it to David. But David would not drink it. He poured it out to the Lord and said, 'Far be it from me before my God that I should do this. Shall I drink the lifeblood of these men? For at the risk of their lives they brought it.' Therefore he would not drink it. These things did the three mighty men. Now Abishai, the brother of Joab, was chief of the 30, and he wielded his spear against 300 men, and killed them, and won a name beside the three. He was the most renowned of the 30, and became their commander, but he did not attain to the three. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant man of Kabzeel, a doer of great deeds. He struck down two heroes of Moab. He also went down and struck down a lion in a pit on a day when snow had fallen. And he struck down an Egyptian, a man of great stature, 5 cubits tall. The Egyptian had in his hand a spear like a weaver's beam, but Benaiah went down to him with a staff and snatched the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. These things did Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and won a name beside the three mighty men. He was renowned among the 30, but he did not attain to the three. And David set him over his bodyguard. The mighty men were Asahel, the brother of Joab, Elhanah, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem, Shemath of Herod, Helez the Pelonite, Ira, the son of Ikesh of Tekoa, Abiezar of Anathoth, Sibekai the Hushathite, Eli the Achahite, Mahariah of Netophah, Heled the son of Bana, Netophah, Ithai the son of Ribai of Gibeah, of the people of Benjamin, Benaiah of Pirathon, Hurai of the brooks of Gash, Abiel the Arbathite, Azmaveth of Bahuma, Baharam, Eliba the Shalbonite, Hashem the Gizanite, Jonathan the son of Shagi the Hararite, Ahiam the son of Sakar the Hararite, Eliphal the son of Ur, Hefer the son of Mekarathite, Ahijah the Pelonite, Hezro of Carmel, Narai the son of Esbai, Joel the brother of Nathan, Mibar the son of Haggai, Zelek the Ammonite, Naharai of Beeroth, the armor-bearer of Joab the son of Zariah, Ira the Ithrite, Gareb the Ithrite, Uriah the Hittite, Zabad the son of Ali, Adina the son of Shiza the Reubenite, a leader of the Reubenites, and 30 with him, Hanan the son of Makkah, Josaphat the Mithnite, Uzziah the Ashterathite, Shama and Jael the son of Hotham the Arorite, Jediel the son of Shimri, and Joha his brother the Tizzite, Eliel the Mehavite, and Jeribai and Joshaviah the sons of Elnam, and Ithma the Moabite, Eliel, Obed, Jasiel the Mezabite, the Mezabite. This is God's word. As we open this up and look at this, I want to tell you a story of me in college. When I was in college, I hurt myself playing Frisbee. It was ultimate Frisbee, so I have a little bit of an excuse. But I jumped up and I landed. It's not much of an excuse because I was by myself when it happened. I jumped up and landed and something went wrong in my knee. But because I'm late to everything, I didn't go to the doctor until about 5 days later. So I limp into the doctor's office. And I never walked again for about 3 months because I ended up having fractured my femur and tore my ACL and MCL. So I walked in and came out on crutches and then was on crutches for 3 months. But those 3 months of limping around, not being able to use my leg, meant that the day I could take my cast off and walk was complete liberation. It was, you'd never appreciate walking if you've never walked for 3 months, like that first time you can. What is this describing? It describes that affliction often helps us appreciate the blessings that we have, and we more clearly see the light that we actually experience. And we see that in Job, that Job's affliction drives him to say amazing things about God. He cries out in chapter 17 that he's living in darkness, but he hopes for light. And the reformers in the Reformation read this line and said, it took that as their motto, post tenebras luz, out of darkness, light. The light of truth, they're saying, shines all the brighter to eyes that have been sensitized by the darkness. And we know that a heart sings so much sweeter to the glory of grace once we've been brought to the precipice of darkness, when we're right on the edge. And we see that in our own lives, that a mother's joy of giving birth to a child is all the greater because there's 9 months of toil and pain that right before that moment that a husband can't even experience. Or in my own life, for Becca and I, there were 3 years of me rejecting Becca and ignoring her before I finally asked her out. That helps Becca to appreciate being married to me so much greater. But as we turn to Israel, what is Israel's darkest moment? Now, this is a hard question for us because Israel kept trying to outdo herself in finding her darkest moment. But one of them was definitely the time of the judges, and this is probably shining as the darkest of moments. Now, what was the catchphrase of Judges? The catchphrase throughout Judges is basically that anarchy stinks and we need a king. And God ended up giving them a king. But last week, we saw that the darkness of Saul's reign actually marred the first kingship. So there was witchcraft, there was murder, it was filled with idolatry. And then it all fades to black as Saul and his whole house are slaughtered in a single day. So God wiped out his own royal line to remove the blight that was on Israel, because he's saying that a wicked king is no better than anarchy. So all Israel, through all of this, is still waiting for their king. But God brings us through darkness so that we can appreciate the light that he brings us to all the greater. So Saul's story ends sharply in chapter 10, and it says that God turned his kingdom from Saul to David. We see that Saul is left behind with no regret from God, and David bursts onto the scene. And we see through the rest of Chronicles that God doesn't look back from here. We don't worship a God who's dwelling on what could have been, because he's the God who's determined what is right now and what is going to be. In chapter 11, this moment that we read right now is the beginning of God's throne. As God establishes his eternal throne here with David, we see him establish it through David's position, next in David's place, and finally in David's power. So we're going to start looking at the first section and see David's position. We see that God chose David as the right king by the way that he establishes David's position. The whole chapter shows David's godly reign, but in this opening section, God is appointing David to leadership. Now, this needs to pique our interest because we as God's people, and actually most people throughout the world, we want to know and do God's will. We want God to tell us, what is your will? And in some ways, our decisions are actually exactly parallel to what we're reading here. When we, for example, elect officers in the church, we aren't choosing what officers we want, but actually we're recognizing the men whom God has chosen, and we are recognizing who those men are. So we need to be able to carefully discern God's will. What is God's desire for us as a church moving forward? Or more indirectly, we can think about this in our personal lives. Say a woman is deciding whether to move away. Maybe she's going to go study somewhere to move forward in her career. She's going to a new place. There's going to be new people. There's going to be new possibilities. Or she can continue where she is, perhaps waiting tables at her normal job, and she's going to stay around the friends and the family and the church that she grew up with. And maybe the guy that she's hoping will look her way finally will, or maybe he won't. Well, what does she want to know? She wants to know, what is God's will? How do I know what God's will is in this juncture? This story of David gives us insight into how we know God's will, and as we see, even in messy situations. Because first of all, the context demonstrates the patience and steadfastness that we need to apply when we seek God's will. If you remember, long time ago from 2 Samuel, that immediately after Saul's death, there was actually two people. There's Ish-bosheth and there's David. And there were years of war as Israel was sorting out who was going to be king. David was anointed by part of Israel, and he ruled in Hebron. But the historical separation is not reflective of redemptive history. Because as we read in Chronicles, that God jumped straight to David as his next king. God knew David was his next king. Chronicles is jumping right to all Israel gathering around David as his king. And this tells us that through the years of strife and confusion that were there at the human level, God was able to clearly reveal his will to his people. And once the dust settles, what do we see? We see all Israel gathering around God's king. These were tribes and people who had been killing each other just right before this. And then they see, oh, this is God's king. We need to come together. And all Israel gathers together under David. Now, this is a beautiful picture for us as a church, because disputes are going to distinguish us. And there is a time and a place to hash things out. As we're trying to sort out what is God's will and God is making things clear, we need to know that all God's people will come together under God. We see this through history. At the very beginning of church history, the fathers were sorting out, how do we describe Christ's divinity? What is the language you would use to describe Christ? And there was confusion and there were arguments, but all of the church came together at the end and said, this is who Christ is. And they were recognizing, this is who Christ has said about him, what Christ has said about himself. We see the same thing in the Reformation, as the church is determining, how are we saved? As they reach justification by faith, it's through arguing back and forth and sides disputing, but the church came together and said, this is what God has taught us about faith. We even see this around us now in denominations. There are different denominations of how do we do different sacraments? How do we do church government? We split over how to do missions. And all of these splits divide the church. But we need to remember that as God's will becomes more and more clear to us, are we drawing back together? We need to make sure that as a church, we aren't letting our pride turn a heated pursuit of God's will into a personal battle. So don't let distinctions in the church divide God's people, because the divisions mar God's glory. I'm not going to go into specifics of what that means for us now, because each of you need to discern in your heart, what is the area that I'm holding out a stubborn personal battle, rather than fighting for God's glory and seeing Christ's will as the thing governing me. So how, to help us with that though, how do the people reach unity in this case? In 1 Chronicles 11, how do they do that? And how do they know that David was God's choice? Well, they tell us in verse 2, they say, to start off, in times past, even when Saul was king, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. Do you see that the first reason that they give is pointing to David's personal demonstration of his ability? Now, we need to note that this isn't pointing to a singular event. They're not saying to David, well, there was that one time you beat that really tall guy in battle, so you should be king over us. And they're not pointing to some superpower that he has. Like, you're strong, the strongest person in all of Israel, so you should be king. No, their standard's actually way more basic than that. They say, David was already acting like a king. He was already being trained for the role that he was going to fulfill. Now, it's much more basic than what we often apply, but it's also much more difficult than the standard we often apply to ourselves. Because David's standard took suffering and many setbacks to learn and grow. Do we see that? They took patience and persistence to grow in a pattern of life, to create this pattern of life, to make him capable of doing this. So say you're finishing high school this year, and you've just barely squeezed into the graduation line because you spent most of your nights gaming late into the night, and you skipped class to go to Six Flags. But then you open your mailbox, and what do you have? You have a letter from MIT, for some reason offering you a full-ride scholarship to study engineering. And you think, this has to be God's will, because there's no way I deserve this. I'm going to turn my life around. Obviously, I have to accept this. I'm going to change my study habits. There's going to be a new me in college, as everyone says. No, that is the worst thing you could do there. That's a horrible idea, because you're not prepared for any of this. Your life hasn't led you to the point where you can accept this opportunity. This isn't who you are. You can't change in the flip of a switch because a new opportunity comes. The lesson from Saul is that the road to hell is paved with good but unproven intentions. So you can't pursue a hope that doesn't have any sort of foundation in reality. The lesson from David is that you're formed by the patterns that you develop. David had formed patterns through a life of shepherding, first as a child shepherding sheep, and then he was shepherding Israel underneath Saul. And then finally he was given the position of shepherd by God. This is why Paul, in his letter to Timothy, warns the elders that you shouldn't be a recent convert. Because if you're a recent convert, you might become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Do you see the seriousness of that? It's not just, I'll go to this place and I might fail at my duty. But Saul didn't just fail at his duty. He fell into the condemnation of God. And we can do the same thing. We jump into something we're not prepared for because we think the opportunity is too good. And it actually leads our whole life away from God. Some of you may have already experienced this in your own life through the school of hard knocks. When an opportunity comes, we need to ask ourselves, has God been preparing me for this? Or if we're assessing someone else, look at their day-to-day patterns. Do they show that they're living a life that's emulating the things that they'll need to do and the duty that the church calls them to? For example, if you're a young woman, this would apply if you're a man as well, but if you're a young woman and you're looking at a guy and you think, man, this guy's got a lot of potential. You shouldn't date or marry a guy with potential. You need to date or marry a guy who actually has those traits. Potential doesn't get you anywhere. It's only once those things actually form. The second reason that the people give David is that the Lord your God said to you, you shall be shepherd over my people Israel, and you shall be a prince over my people Israel. Here they add in, basically saying, oh, and God actually explicitly said this to you earlier. But before we judge Israel too harshly, this should also caution us that sometimes in the moment, discerning the will of God is more confusing than it often seems to us. We can look back in retrospect and say, God spoke clearly, but in the moment it can be more confusing. This should warn us against even desiring explicit prophecies of that kind. It does get more confusing. And we should keep this in mind because when we're sorting out God's will, we often want that sort of clarity. We think life would be easier if an angel came to me in a dream and told me, you know what, Greg, you're going to be an artist who's going to paint beautiful Western landscape scenes and cowboys. Now, that's probably what you wish too. Not the painting part, but the clarity part. Especially when you get stuck between two really good or two really bad options. But learn from David here that God's way is always obscure in the mid-range. Even here for David, he was anointed king, and he was given clear purpose for his life, but he had to wait over a decade before he was crowned. He knew the end, but in all the details, he had to use godly wisdom. He had to go one step at a time, just the same as we do. But imagine how much harder it was for David. Because he knew God's will, but then he was stuck living his life like a normal person. That's where I'm supposed to be. Why am I heading backwards? But maybe that is you. Maybe you're pretty sure you know God's plan. You've reached the moment of clarity. So you're a young guy thinking, I know that she's the right one for me. She is a godly woman. She thinks I'm funny. And she doesn't mind that my mom picks out my outfit for me. And the way I feel about her is unlike anything I felt about anyone else before. David's life shows that even if you know God's purpose, it doesn't remove the twists and the turns, and it doesn't shorten the journey. You have to be patient as the story unfolds, and you have to keep your eye focused on the day-to-day choices you make. Are you staying in the way of righteousness, step by step? When the men of Israel profess that the Lord declared David would be shepherd over Israel, they recount to David the promise that had been ringing in his ears for decades of sleeping on rocks and caves. And he's been hungry and he's thirsty and he's watched friends die in battle and he's fleed an army of a man who's wearing the crown that he's been promised. But for David, any shorter journey to the throne or any straighter journey to the throne was not going to be God's way. He had to wait for God's purpose to unfold in God's way by keeping his walk blameless. And we see later in this section that the patience of David bore fruit here. The years of patient, godly conduct, it testified to all of Israel that the promise that God had made to David was true. And this convinced all of the people of Israel. All of the elders gathered to him and acknowledged his position. David makes a covenant with them, and they anoint him king over all of Israel. Do you see right here the organic beauty of God's work? In God's wisdom and through David's patience, God was received by all of Israel. God achieved his purpose, but David wasn't thrust on the throne when he was unprepared. And the people weren't tyrannized by a leader who they didn't accept or they didn't elect. But here, in this moment, we see God's word through Samuel fulfilled. It's testified by the pattern of David, and it's acknowledged and gladly received by all of the people. So in the covenant of leadership, we see right here, there are three parties: the Creator, the King, and all of the commoners that unite around David in his position. Now this is a picture of the glory of God, because then as much as now is true what was written in Ephesians. Paul says that there's one body and one spirit, just as we are called to one hope, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God over all. So may we, as God's people right now, also strive for such unity under God's will. If God is reigning, we should expect two things. One, that God is continuing to give us direction, but two, that God is bringing unity to his church. In the church, not just for ourselves, we need to be striving for this unity and seeking God's purpose. And as we move on from this, we see that God's approving what Israel is recognizing by giving David a place to reign. In the next section, we see David's place. So David's enthronement doesn't end with a new position and a new title. But we see in verse 4 that he's given a place. Now, a throne is more than just a seat for a king. As you think about a throne, what are the other things that you're thinking about? So you're probably thinking of at the least, a throne room, and there's going to be a castle. And every castle has secret passageways and then trapdoors that lead into dungeons. And then the really great kings have the biggest castles with the coolest trapdoors, and they're on the highest mountains. So if God is trying to distinguish Saul's throne from now David's throne, what place is God going to pick to distinguish David? The place he picks is a place that has ancient roots. So in Genesis 15, going way back to God's promise to Abram, he mentions all of the nations he's going to kick out when he brings them into the promised land. And the last one mentioned are the Jebusites. Now this promise is repeated as we go up to the conquest. Over and over and over again, the Jebusites are always named last. But at this point, all of the people have been defeated. All of them have been conquered except one people, the Jebusites. We're told that in the conquest they were defeated, but they weren't conquered. They weren't kicked out of the land. So the Jebusites kept their stronghold right in the middle of Israel throughout the whole time of the judges and throughout the reign of Saul. But a millennium after God spoke to Abram, now we're going to see God's promise come true. Now it's going to be fulfilled. What we're seeing is a squaring up of ancient enemies. These people who have defied God and Israel for so long are now facing Israel's new king. This is going to be the real test. You can feel the tension as David and his army are ascending the mountain of God, and then the Jebusites are throwing down insults, mocking David, saying, "There's no way you're going to get in here." We're told in Samuel that even if the blind and lame in our city are going to defend against you. So what's David going to do? Well, as we read on, it just says that he conquered it. And we think, well, that was pretty fast. There's kind of a lot of build up for nothing. And the author just spoiled the ending for us. So we have all this fanfare, and it looks just like David walked in the front door and the Jebusites just left out the back. And actually, it's even more boring than that, because David didn't even do anything. He just sends someone else to do it. So Joab walks in the front door, plants David's flag, and the Jebusites are already on their way out. So we're left wondering, did the Jebusites even do anything to defend their stronghold? Now, some of you younger people may not recognize what's going on here, so I'm going to explain and just name it for you. What we have here is a Bronze Age Old Testament power move. So David is not the receiver who's goes into the end zone, scores a touchdown, and then is dancing all around. He scores a touchdown, hands the ball to the ref, and says, "All right, when's this going to get difficult? I didn't even break a sweat." And God is the coach who gets the championship game and then starts all of his bench players just to make the point, this isn't even hard for me. This is a power move. But this is pointing to a deeper truth. Not just as God stating, this is how powerful I am. It doesn't matter what David did. He didn't conquer Jerusalem because he's that good. It's actually pretty clear from the story because he didn't even conquer Jerusalem at all. He sent Joab to conquer Jerusalem. But we're told in verse 5 that David conquered Jerusalem. So David gets the credit because he happens to be in the right place. He's sitting on God's throne. In the same way, we're then told that the city, it was called the City of David, only to read later in the verse that David doesn't build most of it. Joab is the one who builds most of the city. This passage just keeps pointing us away from David. The chapter is showing us that David is like a figurehead, like the British monarchy. He's shown as a caricature because his power is based in what he represents, not actually who he is. David needs a grand place like Jerusalem as his throne because David's holding the place of God's king. God's king. David's sitting in a place that has far more weight than he himself carries. Do you see that? The place that David holds is a place in God's story. This is why God's stamp is on every single part of this story. The first section ends, they anointed David king over Israel according to the word of the Lord by Samuel. And then this section ends, and David became greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him. This is all about God's story. And the main character in this section of God's story is God's throne, not David. God's planting his throne on earth, on which he'll govern the whole world. And David just happens to be the one who's holding it down for the moment. If we don't understand this, then we miss everything. We're just reading a history book of things that people and God did 3,000 years ago. And then when we take out lessons, we're gleaning wisdom, maybe a few things that can encourage us, but generally what the character of God might be like. But the impact and demand in our life is vague and fuzzy. What we need to see when we read this is that God's throne established under David 3,000 years ago and recorded by God here in 1 Chronicles 11 is a throne that Jesus Christ is sitting on right now. It's currently here, and Christ is reigning on it. So the lessons of leadership and discerning God's will from the last point, they aren't just pious advice. This is actually how Christ governs his people. So if an elder is treating his sheep harshly, Christ, the chief shepherd, the king shepherd, is holding his staff and brandishing it, not as a threat, but as something he actually uses. Or if we as a church, if we treat leadership flippantly, or if we are seeking God's will neglectfully, we throw up a prayer and do whatever we want, well, we're insulting Christ's kingdom. We are despising the way that Christ himself rules his church. Do you know what that is? It's treason. And Christ doesn't handle treason well. No king handles treason well. So if we aren't respecting Christ as currently reigning now, we're in really big trouble. Christ mediates his rule through people, but we need to see, brothers and sisters, that it doesn't mean that his hands are bound, or that his mouth is gagged, or that his sword is sheathed. The choice before all men is the same thing that we're reading about right in this chapter here with the Jebusites. It's the question before us is, do you want to win or do you want to lose? Those are the two choices before us. So you're either all Israel who's gathering to subjugate themselves under David, the greater David, Christ, or you're the Jebusites, and you think that you're safe in your ancient stronghold, your secure life that you've built up right in the middle of God's people, Israel, and you think that you're safe there, and all the while you're ignoring or even mocking Christ. Until the day, as we see, that you're wiped out without another mention. This isn't just a pattern we see here, but we see the same thing in Revelation 19. The people of of the beast are gathering together in a great army, and they come against God. And the next verse doesn't talk about the battle at all. It says the beast and the false prophet are thrown into hell. Just like this. It's over like that. There's no honor in a battle that's not even fought. Psalm 2 says, kiss the king, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way. But blessed are all who take refuge in him. There is no honor for those who fight against Christ. But the flip side is that while there won't even be a battle to speak of, for those who come under David, there are blessings forevermore. For them who put themselves in the place of David, David pours out his blessings on them. Not David, but the greater David. So the lesson here is fear the king, for he is mighty. But it's actually better than that. It's better news than just fear driving us to Christ. Because we're actually supposed to be marveling at the glory of Christ that we're offered by him. As we look at the last point, David's power. So the last section ended, David grew mightier and mightier, or David grew greater and greater. And then this is followed by a story of David's mighty men. So imagine you were there 3,000 years ago, and you're sitting around a campfire with this motley crew. And then all of a sudden, these stories start cropping up. Everyone's sharing their scar stories, or the time that they were hiding out, the battles they fought with David, sneaking around in caves, raiding Philistine settlements. But then you start hearing a few stories crop up a little bit louder, and Eleazar starts speaking. Everyone goes quiet because he's one of the big three. These guys are really serious. And he tells about the time that he's fighting with David, and he goes to Pas Damim, and the whole army flees. The whole army he's with is just running away, and he decides, nope, I've had it, I'm going to stop here. And he turns around in the middle of a barley field, and he fights off the whole Philistine army. That's pretty amazing. But then next to him, there's his friend Jashobeam. And he's leaning on a spear, and he's telling somebody about the time that he killed 300 people with that spear. 300 people. So imagine that every single seat in this whole room was filled. And then all of you guys charge at me. And then all of your seats are filled up again, and then those people charge at me too. And then I kill all of you. That's how many people that this guy killed. That's pretty crazy. But then, as all these stories are being told, you hear that he wasn't even the only one. Because Athaliah is there, and he also killed 300 people. And you're wondering, what on earth is going on? Because you realize that you're not sitting among ordinary men here. You're sitting among living legends. The things they do, we can't even fathom. This is incredible. And then the crowd turns, and you hear this guy, Benaiah, speak up. And he's got this quiet voice. He's got this calm about him. But it's a shyness that betrays that underneath that it's a certain kind of crazy that you don't want to mess with. Because it describes him here as a doer of mighty deeds. And he's telling this time about he fought off two heroes of Moab, is what it says. But the word underneath that is what we translate as heroes is lion-like men. He fought off two lion-like men and then decides, well, that wasn't that bad. I got to go find the real thing. So he climbs into a snowy pit and he kills a real lion. And then as he's getting into this story about killing this tall Egyptian, 5 cubits tall, grabs his spear and stabs him with his own spear. But then you hear a voice in the back, quiet voice, but confident. And he says, 5 cubits. I've seen bigger, but that's pretty good. And the crowd parts, and you see David sitting there among his people. And he's amused by the exploits of his mighty men. And the humility of his heart you see because he finds his greatest joy and the depiction of his own glory in the feats of his own people. And as the attention turns to David, the big three, the three mighty men, launch into the one time that they fought through the Philistine army, stopped in the middle of the army, grabbed some water from a well, and fought their way back out because David was thirsty. And then they give that water to David, the sacred water, and he looks at it and says, okay, and then pours it on the ground. But if you're sitting around that campfire, I want to say three things that you would be struck by. So the first is that these people are amazing. Do you listen to their stories? That any one of these people would be legendary figures just on his own. And you're thirsting to wonder, how on earth do you kill 300 people with a spear? How do they do any of these things? But then their mighty deeds turn your attention to see that the love that they have for David. Look at how they look to him. They run in for him. They rescue him. They die with him. They'll risk their lives even to quench his thirst. What's shining the brightest is these men love David. And then the third thing that even that points you to is that if David's won such loyalty and affection from such legendary figures, you begin to look at David and see him more clearly. Do you see his power? We haven't even heard anything that David has done. But if all of these warriors' men's hearts beat for that man, that David, then you're overcome with how powerful David must be. And now is the time that I want to remind you that the story's not about David. Because even David here knows that. So when those men grabbed the water and they brought it back to him, he doesn't drink the water that his men risked their lives to retrieve because he knows that he of himself isn't worth it. He's not worthy of such devotion. So instead he treats the water with the highest devotion and he pours it out as a drink offering to God and says, "This is the best I can do with what you've given me. You've given me your blood. I'm giving it to the Lord." Do you see that David himself loved God? And he's just riding the coattails, sitting on Christ's throne. And he knows it. Now this is the power of God's throne. When Christ gathers together all of his church, his whole church, we are going to be swapping stories, telling of all the amazing things that God has done through us. And if you think that the stories around David's campfire are amazing, then you need to wait for the real thing. Because we're going to be sharing such unbelievable feats, and they're all going to be soaked in love and devotion for Christ. We'll see men and women speaking of sacrifice and daring adventures they took because their affections were wooed by the magnetism of Christ himself. That nothing was worth holding back, that no risk was too great, and no path was too painful or tedious or long. Because every man has his will, every man and woman has their will overcome by Christ. We'll hear people from North Korea escaping out of that land of tyranny, being converted in China, and then walking back into North Korea to tell their families and then die. We'll also hear stories of young men whose families have been mocking them their whole life because they turned to Christ. And those are going to be held up as showing Christ's glory. You suffered through this. And this is who Christ is because of that devotion you had to Christ through all of this. You're going to hear of the man in a difficult marriage who loved his wife through all of the harassment that she gave him. Or the woman who lost her children or lost her job. And suffered through that, clinging on to the hope of Christ, because that was all that she had through the difficult times. You're going to hear of the young people who were tempted to flee like their friends as they were giving up their faith, but then had that moment where they realize, you know what, no, I'm going to make my stand here, and they stood alone. These are the moments we're going to tell about in the age to come. Amen. Yet all of these stories aren't going to leave us looking around at one another. We're not going to be amazed at these fantastic stories. No, all these stories won't be able to look around because every song of exploit is carrying the same melody of devotion and love that's pointing to Christ and showing Christ's power, Christ's glory. We'll be overcome with awe at the majesty of Christ, who has such power and glory. And then he's so graciously smiles on us, calls us brothers and sisters. And then he rejoices to demonstrate his power in us, lifting us up to say, "This is a brother of mine. This is a sister of mine." That is the glory of Christ. May our souls yearn for that day when we'll see Christ face to face. Let's come in prayer. O Lord, you are majestic and on high, and you yourself are seated above the cherubim and seraphim, too high to understand, too majestic to even be visible. And yet you have given us your Son to look upon and see who you are. As we look to Christ reigning on his throne, may we not neglect the position you have put him in. May we look to Christ to guide us, look to Christ to be the center of our church and the center of our lives. And may that turn our eyes to see his glory, that day to day we are seeing ourselves not living before men, but living before Christ himself. And may that change the way that we live. May we see Christ exalted, and may be willing to stand for him. For we pray all this in Christ's name. Amen.